Morning, Council. Ready to proceed? Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I would like to introduce Rob Wolf, no relation to my partner Don Wolf, of the Cleveland, Ohio firm of Duven, Kahn, and Hutton, who will be presenting the argument on behalf of respond or the FLE this morning.
Welcome, Mr. Wolf.
Thank you very much.
Of course, you as well, Mr. Wolf.
Thank you.
Three.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. My name is John Reed. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Thomas Kong. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce at council table my partner, Thomas McGonigal, and in the first pew in the back, the appellant, Mr. Kong. If I could, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you. This is an appeal from an advancement action, and there are two overarching issues that are presented, and that is whether it was proper for the Court of Chancery to order Mr. Kong to pay back previously advanced funds, and number two, whether it was proper for the Court of Chancery to shift all of the fees associated with the entire defense of the matter below based upon some bad faith acts taken by counsel below. Before proceeding to the legal arguments, what I'd like to do is briefly discuss the undisputed background facts, and then I'll focus on the more significant undisputed facts and the appropriate portions of the legal argument. Mr. Kong had a long history with Coal National, starting back in 1979 to 1990, and then again from 1999 to 2002. Coal is a company engaged in the optic business. Mr. Kong started out as its controller, eventually rising to the position of executive vice president, chief administrative officer, and then he left the company in 1990 to pursue other interests. But it was during this first stint with the company that he first became acquainted with the company's litigation team, a man by the name of Malcolm Kelso and an attorney by the name of Stephen Sundrum. Mr. Kelso also served a brief period of time as a member of the board of directors of Coal. In 1999, Coal's then chairman and CEO, Jeffrey Coal, convinced Mr. Kong to come back to the company, and he eventually became the company's chief financial officer. By mid-2002, Mr. Kong helped the company find a replacement for him, and he spent several months working with his successor, transitioning his duties, and he retired. Unfortunately, Arthur Anderson was the company's auditors, and the company ultimately had to restate its financials with regard to how it booked certain revenues associated with warranties on its products. That restatement, no doubt, led to stockholder lawsuits and an SEC investigation. The company immediately went out and hired the law firm of Jones Day, which is the law firm of the former law firm of the general counsel, to represent both the company and all the individual defendants. The board immediately approved the retention of counsel for the individuals on a pay-as-you-go basis, subject to the submission of a standard written undertaking. Then, several months later, in March of 2003, Mr. Kong and the other individual defendants were told that they would have to retain separate counsel. Mr. Kong immediately was never a defendant in a lawsuit before. He turned to the legal team that he knew, one that the company knew, Mr. Kelso and Mr. Sundrum.
Why do you refer to Mr. Kelso as a part of a legal team?
Well, Your Honor, I wish I knew, you know, that may not be proper. He advised the company for years with regard to litigation matters. What was important to Mr. Kong in this case is that Mr. Kelso was very, very familiar with the company and the inner workings of the company, and he wanted somebody there who had been on the inside that could assist both him and his lawyer in connection with the SEC matter. Mr. Kelso also represented many other parties assisting lawyers in connection with SEC investigations.
Does he give legal advice?
Your Honor, I think that's an open question, probably one for another forum, another day. I can't say specifically what he does. He's certainly not in court representing people. He's not taking depositions. He's not signing and filing briefs.
What does the record reflect about when anyone knew about Mr. Kelso's colorful background?
Well, Your Honor, I was just about to get to that. The fact of the matter is Mr. Kelso is the former brother-in-law of the then chairman CEO, Jeffrey Cole. And before retaining them, Mr. Kong went to the chairman and CEO and said, would it be okay? He said yes, and he retained them.
My question is, when did Mr. Kong know about Mr. Kelso's colorful background?
Your Honor, I'd be speculating because that's really not anywhere in the record as to when he knew that. I can only say that based upon my personal knowledge of the situation, which is outside the record, that all of this background came to his attention subsequent to the lawsuit. mean, some of the really bad stuff, frankly, that's in the record associated with what Mr. Kelso did in other actions, not this particular action. Immediately after retaining Mr. Kelso and Mr. Sundra, on March 23rd, 2003...
I'm sorry,
Your Honor.
Was a bit distracted. You indicated you were going to tell us about the undisputed facts.
Yes.
Is it undisputed that the then CEO of Cole authorized the hiring of Kelso?
Yeah, I will touch on that. This is what the record is. Mr. Kong testified that he went to Mr. Jeffrey Cole, asked if it would be okay, and he said yes. He subsequently retained them, then submitted a written undertaking to the board on March 23rd, 2003. The board, 4 days later on March 27th, approved the hiring of independent counsel for Mr. Kong. Not specifically Mr. Kelso or Mr. Sundra, but approved the hiring of independent counsel after review of the written undertaking. To answer Your Honor's specific question, the only other contradictory part of the record is Leslie Dunn testified that Jeffrey Cole never told her that he authorized this. But that doesn't answer the question. Jeffrey Cole never told me. He may not have told many people. She never said, I specifically asked Mr. Cole whether he authorized the retention of Mr. Kelso, and he said no. And they could have very easily called Mr. Cole at trial.
I consider it undisputed
because the other aspect of the record, I don't think you can draw any conclusion from, because it doesn't answer the precise question.
Well, and while we're talking about what's undisputed, I think it is undisputed that Mr. Kelso had this colorful background, and that really is a euphemism.
No doubt about that.
And the legal question is, should the company have just kept paying money until the indemnification proceeding, or did the Court of Chancery properly stop and take a look at this during the advancement phase?
That is in part, Your Honor. I would agree with you in part on that. I think the Court of Chancery had the authority to say, in the limited context of the advancement proceeding, I can look at these guys' credentials, and I'm not going to order the company to pay him on a going forward basis. And Mr. Kong, if you do it at your own risk. And if you can prove he was necessary in a subsequent indemnification action, so be it. But I'm not going to order the company to do it on a going forward basis. But what happened here is a little different. After the retention, the bills that Mr. Kong incurred from both Mr. Kelso and Mr. Sundra were submitted. The company paid Mr. Kelso's invoices through May of 2003, totaling about $150,000. Invoices submitted subsequent to that remained unpaid. As to Mr. Sundra, his bills were not paid timely, and by January of 2004, the bills going back to September 2003 remained unpaid. On January 7th, this is about a week before the lawsuit's filed, Mr. Kong sends a notice of default on the payments to the company. On January 12th, Mr. Cole's counsel, Mr. Robert Wook, who's going to be present and make the argument on behalf of the appellee here today, sent a letter to Mr. Kong rejecting the contention that the company was in default. That's at B-112 of the record. This lawsuit was then filed later that day. Then, notwithstanding what was in that letter from their counsel to Mr. Kong, the company paid the bills. They sent it with a cover letter, sent Airborne Express, that was received the next day, the day after this lawsuit was filed. At least Mr. Sundra's bills, not Mr. Kelso's. This case then proceeded to a one-day trial and resulted in a final order that I think properly declared, for a limited purpose, Mr. Kelso to be an invalid representative to receive advancement payments going forward. But then it required Mr. Kong to repay $150,000 representing previously advanced funds associated with Mr. Kelso. It also required him to repay what was about a total of $16,000 and then refused to order the company to pay an outstanding balance of $65,000 associated with the lawyer's consultation with Mr. Kelso. And then finally, the award shifted fees for the entire defense in the amount of $300,000 as a consequence of actions taken during a deposition and also the filing of deposition notices. This now brings us to the legal argument. I submit that there are multiple reasons why the Court of Chancery erred when it went back and ordered Mr. Kong to repay previously advanced funds. Number one, which I think is a powerful procedural legal argument, no counterclaim was ever filed, no claim of set-off or equitable set-off was ever made in the answer. But beyond that, the company, on multiple occasions, expressly represented that it was not seeking repayments of previously advanced funds. For example, I'll go through a couple of them. In a January 20th, 2004 letter to Mr. Kelso, Mr. Dubin, Mr. Robert Wolf's partner, said, quote, it is not our intention to challenge or attempt to recover any previously paid professional costs, unquote. That's at A235. Then during a March 17th, 2004 deposition of Leslie Dunn, the company's general counsel, the following question was asked, and this can be found at A357 of the record. Question, is it your intention, speaking on behalf of Coal National Corporation as a 30B6 witness, to seek to, quote, challenge or attempt to recover previously paid professional costs? She was instructed not to answer that question, and Mr. Whoops said that Mr. Sundra should take that issue to the Court of Chancery. Mr. Sundra responded later, still at 357 of the record, I'm entitled to know what the claims, defenses, and counterclaims are in this case. Answer for Mr. Wood. You are entitled to know the counterclaims once they are filed. You are not entitled to know what claims the council is thinking about doing in regard to counterclaims that may be filed. None were ever filed. Beyond that, April...
And why does your opponent say in their answering brief that Cole notified Kong of the counterclaim in writing before trial as well as at trial?
Well, it was certainly before trial. Beyond two subsequent instances to the two I mentioned, which can be found at A236 and A387 of the record, where they again said they weren't seeking recoupment, in their trial brief and in the pretrial order, they proposed to seek recoupment. The court ultimately awarded it, but that was the first time. Discovery had closed, there had never been any claim. The court awarded it, and even the court initially expressed some skepticism. This is what the vice chancellor said. I don't see how, in this context, in this limited a record, I should go back and make a determination that, you know, you should be able to recoup or withhold all the monies that you paid. I submit the vice chancellor got it right the first time. The opinion cites no authority for being able to go back in the middle of an advancement proceeding and recoup previously advanced funds. The only legal authority that I've seen for that proposition shows up in their brief, and it's the equitable cleanup doctrine. That doesn't, you know, as the court knows, the equitable cleanup doctrine allows the Court of Chancery to hear legal claims arising out of a case over which it's already exercised equitable jurisdiction. The doctrine has never been applied.
Well, perhaps your comment that there had been no discovery on the counterclaim will answer this question, but how was your client prejudiced by this decision being made at the advancement stage, given the facts that were known to the parties at that time?
Well, he was prejudiced in several respects, Your Honor. First of all, the action is contrary to Delaware law, because Delaware law, as I understand it, both in the Reddy case and Berganzi and a number of others, is that the court's not to determine the ultimate right to indemnification in the advancement proceeding. And what happened here is he's now left what is essentially a legal determination on liability under his written undertaking. Yet, we don't even know what the final outcome of the underlying proceeding in which he's seeking advancement is. And really, when that's over, that's the best evidence of determining whether or not all the stuff that he incurred is reasonable.
You talking about the ongoing SEC?
Ongoing SEC. See, and let me just pause for a second to give the court the status of that. In January, he entered into, or in December, Mr. Kong entered into a tolling agreement, and just last month he received a Wells notice from the SEC, as did seven or eight other either directors or officers of the company. So the matter is ongoing. So he was prejudiced in the respect that, frankly, he's victim of a legal determination contrary to Delaware law. He was also precluded from taking discovery or challenging that kind of claim. If that kind of claim had been filed, he could have immediately filed a motion to dismiss, very similar to the one granted by the chancellor in Berganzi versus Rite Aid, where the court said you cannot stop advancement or go after previously advanced funds until the underlying action has concluded. It hasn't concluded here. The other, and he was denied discovery on this. He was also denied the opportunity to challenge standing because, as I'll get to later, the company actually sought reimbursement for these funds from the D&O carrier and received it.
What kind of discovery would have been involved?
In that case, well, Your Honor, we could have looked to see maybe what kind of side agreements they had with the company, et cetera, associated to how they got that money from the insurance company on behalf of its insurer, which is Mr. Kong. And that would have been a powerful legal argument. What we were really denied more than anything is not the discovery was sort of important, but we were denied the opportunity to make the appropriate legal arguments simply because they raised what's essentially either a declaration, a counterclaim in the form of a declaratory judgment, or a substantive counterclaim. they fail to do it. They just make the arguments, and we're left with the consequences of not being able to respond to it appropriately.
To what extent do you think the Vice Chancellor's views about the abuse of the discovery process up to that point may have influenced his decision to resolve the case at this level, or at this stage?
Your Honor, I think that the Vice Chancellor, in reading it, it's clear in reading the opinion, was very, very disappointed with the performance of the former lawyers below. There's no doubt about that. And I intend to address that in a separate aspect of related to the fees. I just want to make two quick comments, because I'm beyond actually my rebuttal.
Well, was he also concerned about the performance of the Delaware lawyers?
I think he was. I certainly was. I remain concerned about the performance of the Delaware lawyers. I think they could have done a better job of controlling the situation. But here's the thing, and when you're looking at that with respect to the fees, you make the company whole by forcing Mr. Kong to pay all the fees associated with the misconduct, all the fees associated with the deposition, all the fees associated with having to file a motion for protective order on the deposition that were noticed. But the problem here is there's no analysis in the opinion as to how these instances of misconduct simply lead to a $300,000 award against a person who now has to live with that and at the same time fight the SEC.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Your Honor, I'm going to cut into it and maybe I'll get to 2 minutes because I think there are a couple other important arguments I want to make. The contract analysis, I'll live with what's in the briefs. I think we went through that. It's contrary to the indemnification agreement to come back in the advancement stage and get a determination on the written undertaking. But what's more important here is the policy. If you allow a company to challenge basically indemnification in the advancement proceeding, it results in a bunch of mini trials. You know, they get a couple sets of bills, they're okay with it, they get another set of bills, they're not okay with it, they want to go into the court of chancery, they want to have that resolved, when that doesn't promote judicial economy because those same issues have to be addressed later in the subsequent indemnification proceeding.
Help me understand your argument, because I think I'm confused. I thought you had said earlier it was all right in the advancement stage to have an interruption to discuss reasonableness, especially under circumstances like this that are pretty egregious. But, as I understood your argument, to the extent money had been paid, you don't order it repaid at the advancement stage. You deal with that at the end in indemnification.
That's right. I think there are limits on the Court of Chancery as to what it can do at the advancement stage. I think the court could say, you know, if you came in and you said, I'm a single individual, but I want Skadden, Wachtell, Lipton, and Karas and Waymore, and I want the company to pay for it, and I want three financial advisors, I think the court can say, you know what, you're entitled to one lawyer, you're entitled to one financial advisor. If you want to hire three and you think you can justify it later, you do it, but you do it at your own peril. I think there are certain things the court can do, and I think here the court could say Mr. Kong did not meet his burden of establishing Mr. Kelso as a qualified representative for purposes of advancement and leave that issue for a later day.
But as I understand your argument, you think it should have been totally prospective.
Yes.
And to the extent payments had already been made, you deal with that at the end.
Yes, or at least we should have been put on notice of the claim. Your Honor, I think I will stop now and revisit some of this in the rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you.
The issues raised in this appeal. Before I get to my prepared statements, I would like to address just a few of the things that Mr. Reed said out of the order of my prepared presentation. Mr. Reed very curiously said that Mr. Kelso had assisted other lawyers with SEC investigations. Well, if that was the case, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, I don't know, that would be the first indication of any shred a background qualification that Mr. Kelso may or may not possess that my client has received since 2003 when its general counsel and its outside corporate counsel said, Mr. Kong, why the heck do you need a non-lawyer advisor in addition to counsel? All future payment of fees are at issue if you don't let us know what this individual's qualifications are. Through the pretrial period, through the discovery period during trial, including interrogatories and serial requests for supplementation through attempts to depose the trial itself. No one suggested that Mr. Kelso had ever assisted another lawyer with an SEC investigation. Curious to hear an oral argument that representation is made. Number two, the representation was just made to you that there's nothing in the record regarding what was or was not shared with Mr. Kong about Mr. Kelso's record. There actually is reference on Mr. Dent's cross-examination of Stephen Sundra, the lawyer who, as far as we know, still represents Mr. Kong in the SEC investigation. On pages 129 and 130, Mr. Sundra testifies...
This is 129 and 130 of what? The appendix?
Of the transcript of the trial itself, Your Honor.
Is this in the appendix anywhere?
We can get you a transcript site before the...
Yes, Your Honor. I'll find the page.
Okay. He testifies that I had conversations with him relative to there were problems in Mr. Kelso's past and that he would go too far in cases, and I was giving him advice to limit his involvement further down. But in fact, you didn't even suggest to Mr. Kong that he discuss what you told him about Mr. Kelso with Mr. Kelso. Isn't that true? That's correct. And?
That's the record site is transcript B33.
And of course, it's not surprising that he didn't have that discussion or make that suggestion because, as the record reflected was the case in prior proceedings not involving Mr. Kong as well, Mr. Kelso referred this case to Mr. Sundra. Mr. Reed says that Mr. Kelso was properly declared for a limited purpose as an illegitimate representative. We would ask, what's a limited purpose? You either are or are not a proper representative under the indemnification agreement, and that surely goes to this court's requirement that the advancement be reasonable. If Mr. Kelso was not a proper representative, and I think the evidence pretty overwhelmingly establishes he was not, then any payments made to him via advancement or indemnification are per se unreasonable and are an improper expenditure of corporate funds and under Rogan should not be made.
Mr. Reed's position is that to the extent that determination was made, there would be no need to make future advancements, but to the extent payments had already been made, that should be decided at the end, and the ruling in this case was premature. It should have been part of the indemnification proceeding.
And Justice Holland, our response to that would be twofold, I guess. Number one, Mr. Kong, through counsel, brought the issue of Mr. Kelso's legitimacy or illegitimacy as a representative into the Chancery Court in a proceeding that they instituted. The record overwhelmingly established that he was not a qualified representative. Thus, the expenditures were not reasonable. Thus, there was no additional discovery to be done. There was no additional analysis to be undertaken. It was textbook res judicata. If he was an illegitimate representative, then it follows, we believe, like the fall follows the summer, that any payments made on behalf of Mr. Kelso were illegitimate payments. And there was no further, there was no further adjudication that needed to be taken. I believe the issue of the counterclaim is very much a red herring. The fact that we were seeking a return of some of the fees paid both to the Sundra Law Firm and to Mr. Kelso was something that was developed in terms of our expressing it a little bit later, and I did advise Ms. Dunn, the general counsel, in March, the very beginning of this troubling litigation experience, not to answer what our current thinking was as to whether or not to formally pursue a counterclaim because it was work product at that time. But I think Mr. Reed would be very, very hard-pressed to find any discovery that was denied his client. That goes to the legitimacy of Mr. Kelso, a comparison of the fees charged by the other law firms and the O'Rourke and Sundra firm, or the entire file of the insurance payments, because they received every stitch in every document pertaining to any of those.
Well, you referred to it as a formal counterclaim. Was there ever a formal counterclaim in this case?
No, we never filed a counterclaim. We began doing discovery, including depositions of the individual who represented Jeffrey Call. That was clearly during discovery comparing fees. We sent several letters questioning the fees, and by May, we were clearly communicating in a variety of ways that we were going to seek repayment of fees, and we indeed made that argument very clearly in our pretrial brief.
Now, I understand that's your argument, and I understand your res judicata argument, but what I don't understand is the legal basis for you to get relief for past fees in the absence of a formal counterclaim. In other words, how did you legally present the issue to the Court of Chancery that said, we're were entitled to repayment?
We presented two components to that. Number one, Mr. Kelso's fees. We presented that by indicating the absolute lack of qualification of Mr. Kelso, who was not even present at trial as a representative.
Well, I understand that. Let me state this a different way. If you take an appeal to the Delaware Supreme Court,
yes,
and there's not, and then your opponent does not cross appeal, your opponent doesn't get relief affirmatively. They can protect the judgment, but if they want affirmative relief, they have to be able to file a cross appeal. In this particular case, your client wanted to stop making future payments. But when it was over, not only did they stop have to make future payments, they were ordered to be entitled to reimbursement for the past payments. What was the legal vehicle that put that issue before the Court of Chancery?
Okay. First legal vehicle is the inherent power of the Court of Chancery once he issues his order and makes his factual findings to enforce it. Once the illegitimacy was determined, he had the inherent power. And indeed, as a matter of common sense, the practical power as well to give meaning to his award and to his finding. That's number one. Number two.
Well, just before you go to number two, assume with number one that there are no disputed facts about the basis on which he would exercise that authority. Let's say his authority to do so in the air is not in dispute. That is inherent authority. Let's assume that for a moment. But I take the complaint from the other side about the way in which this was handled to be that they were never given enough notice or given an opportunity after notice before the court to present a set of facts that would put in issue the basis for him to exercise that authority. And while that may be tied in part to finding Kelso not qualified as an expert, as a matter of procedural fairness, how do you square exercising the authority with a lack of opportunity, as they claim, to get all the facts before the court determines to exercise that authority?
Because, Mr. Chief Justice, the facts that had to be determined went to reasonableness. Reasonableness of the status of Mr. Kelso. And once that determination was made, the only subset of remember, the whole concept of advancement, although a separate and distinct concept according to your opinions, is also a subset of the larger diagram of indemnification. Once in the advancement context, a decision of unreasonableness was entered into as to a particular individual, then there is no choice but, and I guess you could say, well, you have to go back at the end of this experience and come back, but the decision would have already been made. It was determined, and there was a full hearing, and it's not been suggested what evidence Mr. Kong's counsel were precluded from introducing or what discovery they would have needed other than one instruction to my general counsel in March not to divulge work product at the time. Other than that, there's not a hint of prejudice here. This all followed naturally from the decision that Mr. Kong...
It did, but we would have... I guess what surprises me is realizing that Vice Chancellor could have said, I'm ruling on your counterclaim, you're entitled to recoup everything you've paid so far. Given the procedural posture of this case, I would have looked for something in the record that would have said, in the absence of a counterclaim, I can't rule on your reimbursement. It looks like you'll have to take that up during indemnification, but to the extent I've made a definitive ruling today, it could be either res judicata or collateral estoppel. And you're suggesting that the Vice Chancellor could skip all of those procedural niceties and say, I've just had a hearing that demonstrates fairly conclusively this fellow Kelso shouldn't have been involved from day one. Therefore, I'm just going to exercise my inherent authority and say, not only don't you have to pay him in the future, but you can get all the money back that you paid in the past.
And we really do believe that the whole notion of the requirement for a counterclaim is a red herring. But even if we adopt that view of the world, we know that this claim was raised at least a couple weeks before trial in formal court pleadings. We know that it was addressed.
I must have misunderstood you. I thought you said there was no formal counterclaim?
There was in the trial brief and our proposed trial order a request for a return of monies.
What is your authority for allowing a counterclaim in a proceeding that's supposed to be summary in nature?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's one of the reasons that we didn't, at the end of the day, formally file a counterclaim. Vice Chancellor Lamb had made it very clear, and I think by the time of trial, it was clear to him in which direction his frustration should be directed, but that this summary proceeding was turning into, as he said, a three-ring circus. Once it became clear to us the scope of the misconduct on the part of opposing counsel and the professional career of misconduct on the part of Mr. Kelso, just as with a month before the hearing date, it didn't seem to make sense to file separate motions to compel, it didn't seem to make sense to file separate counterclaims, we indicated in our trial brief that we were going to be seeking return of monies. We provided everything in discovery that we relied upon during the discovery period, which were the comparable fees, which were all of the insurance information, everything submitted to the insurance company.
Well, as a matter of law, what is your contention as to the type of counterclaims that are compulsory, if any, or permissive in a summary proceeding to determine advancement of fees?
I don't think this would have been a compulsory counterclaim, Justice Ridgely, because it's something that could, of course, be raised again at the indemnification procedure. But I think I don't think in the Chancery Court we need to look at this as a matter of when a counterclaim has to be raised rather than as a matter of giving effect to a judgment following a trial. But if we do look at it that way, then we need to only look at this court's opinion in Grand Ventures versus Whaley, where they talk about amending to conform to the evidence and the broad discretion.
But that wasn't a summary proceeding, was it?
No, it was not a summary proceeding. But this was a summary proceeding that was brought... No, in fact, it had to do with the negligence claim in that case. It was not even a chancery proceeding at all. So that wasn't a case about the inherent power of a court to give effect to a ruling, but that was a case about the evidence that was presented and the broad discretion, even after the close of the evidence, to allow claims and to give relief according to the evidence presented. Mr. McNally discussed in his opening statement. We actually didn't have opening statements, but he made an introductory remark about the fact that he understood that was going to be part of the trial. And it was litigated. And the order to return the $150,000 to Call that had been advanced to Mr. Kelso was simply a reflection of the fact that a corporation cannot advance or at the end of the day indemnify for unreasonable fees. This is not a situation like Braganzi or the myriad of other cases, Kapoor, Tafin, Senior Tor, where you have a former corporate official who is then usually sued by his former corporation involved in criminal misconduct, serious securities misconduct, and the allegation is some form of, well, we can't be forced to advance fees to this fellow. Look at the terrible things he's doing. Look how he's outside the course and scope. Look how he's injured his former employer. That can't be what advancement means. Well, that's exactly what advancement means. And that isn't our situation here. And no one has suggested that Mr. Kong is not entitled to vigorous legal representation. We've already paid his lawyers $575,000in representing his interests before the SEC. And nobody's claiming that the determination made by the vice chancellor following the summary proceeding affects Mr. Kong's right to indemnity of fees incurred by appropriate legal or other professional representatives, including, you know, the record reflects that Jeff Call, the former CEO, used Ten Eyck, an accounting firm. There are a lot of experts that are absolutely appropriate in this situation. But once you have the quantum of evidence that Malcolm Kelso wasn't only an illegitimate representative, but was, you know, something that in your most bizarre imagination you couldn't have concocted, then it follows absolutely that the corporation couldn't, under the Rovin decision, lawfully advance those monies. It doesn't make any difference what Jeff Call had to say. That Jeff Call's former brother-in-law was Malcolm Kelso is all the more reason why the general counsel had to say, please explain why you have Malcolm Kelso in this experience and what he's bringing to the table. It's res judicata. There's no way that Mr. Reed or successor counsel can go back to court at the indemnity stage and argue that Mr. Kong is entitled to retain that $150,000. Now, as to the legal fees that are at issue, there was approximately $65,000 that were unpaid at the time of trial, and the court denied advancement of legal fees for those that hadn't been paid, and there was an extra $15,000 or so that he also ordered to be reimbursed. And that represented the amount of time, we think just a very small percentage, but that Mr. Sundra and Mr. O'Rourke spent interacting, dealing with, enabling, if you will, Malcolm Kelso. Although they obviously agreed to neither the fee shifting nor the reimbursement, the numbers for both were those suggested by Mr. Kong's counsel. And once again, that doesn't go to Mr. Kong's right to indemnity. It doesn't go to his right to continue to vigorously enforce his rights through qualified legal counsel. It doesn't even go to O'Rourke and Sundra's right to continue being his counsel if they are, as much of a mistake as that may be. What it goes to is Mr. Kelso's legitimacy or lack thereof, and that was an issue that was brought to the court by Mr. Kong. And once the vice chancellor reached his decision, he was allowed to give effect to the judgment. It was known before.
I'd like to ask you another question about the cleanup doctrine in a summary proceeding type of case. Let's assume a books and records case, which is a summary proceeding, and the books and records are going across the chancellor's bench, and he says, hey, there's a breach of fiduciary duty here. Can he enter other orders in that circumstance, award money damages, do things like that?
In that situation, I don't feel qualified to give you an answer, although my gut says no.
All right, well, why wouldn't that reason for a negative apply here?
Because that's a separate cause of action that might be related to or derivative of the books and records cause of action, and I'm walking on thin ice here, talking to the Delaware Supreme Court about an action under a statute I've never really become familiar with. But this is not a separate cause of action. This is the claim that was brought to the court by Mr. Kong, and once the representative was declared illegitimate, it wasn't a reach to say, well, then, you know, there may be some derivative cause of action. For example, we asked the vice chancellor to discount the fees of O'Rourke and Sundra because we also thought it constituted churning. And we had a lot of evidence at trial comparing their fees, representing one witness, one day of testimony, having played no role in any meaningful way in the securities class action, to that of Jones Day, responding to 20 requests for production of documents, representing 15 witnesses, and the fees were equivalent. And the vice chancellor didn't go there at all. He limited his ruling to the natural and necessary consequence of his finding that Mr. Kelso was an illegitimate representative. The time based on the hours suggested by Mr. Kong's counsel that O'Rourke and Sundra spent with Mr. Kelso and the monies already provided to Mr. Kelso. And it's not at all clear what additional evidence possibly could be put before the vice chancellor or any other court on that issue. If I could, very briefly, I would like to...
I'm afraid your time is up.
Oh. I'm sorry.
155 is your adversary's remaining time.
Gotcha. Thank you, Your Honor.
Got 3 points I want to emphasize. I apologize if I speak quickly. The issue of amending the pleadings to conform with the evidence, the pretrial order precluded an amendment of the pleading, so that certainly was not possible. Let me focus on what the court has to balance here. The law, it's implicit in the law that directors may well get advancement that they're not entitled to. But the way that we deal with that is in the subsequent indemnification proceeding, if they deliver the written undertaking, the company is protected because it's got the right to get that money back in that action after we know all the circumstances and what the outcome is. There is no remedy for a director whose defense is disrupted because he has to simultaneously defend against intense inquiries as to the reasonableness of what he's doing. Plus, the company, if it's truly adverse to him, could use that kind of proceeding to inquire into trial strategy, et cetera, et cetera. That's why, as a policy matter, that stuff is better left to the indemnification proceeding. But let me turn to what I think is really the ironic fact in this case. After this case was filed, the general counsel wrote a letter to AIG seeking reimbursement of the very fees at issue in this case with an express representation that they were reasonable. That's at A97 to 104 of the record. And I would encourage the court to look at it. It wasn't a mistake. It's a very detailed letter. It says who represents who, why the fees are reasonable, it gives a schedule, et cetera, et cetera. Then, 6 weeks later, after independent review by its counsel, the insurance company paid the bills. That's a payment on our client's behalf that was retained by the company. They were made whole as to this money that he has to pay back.
Are these the past fees?
These are the past fees, Your Honor. If I may, I just want to sort of sum up as to what I think the court, what we'd like to see the court do here. We'd like to see the court undo the recoupment award, knowing that the it's all going to be tried ultimately and the right thing will be done in a subsequent indemnification proceeding, and remand the case for a deeper analysis of the fee award. If I could just take 2 seconds to sum up, so that Mr. Kong doesn't have to pay $300,000 associated with his lawyer's misconduct, but only that harm associated with what they actually caused.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for excellent briefs and an excellent argument. I'm sorry, Mr. Wolf, that you felt like you might have gotten cut off at the end. That was not the intention, but we all enjoyed your arguments. You'll hear from us shortly.
Please rise.